So what would you, you know, okay, so we have this data, we have these facts. If we need extraordinary data,
yeah.
What could we put in the place of resurrection?
Well, in the place of resurrection, but it's the continuous activity of Christ, as is supposedly supported by the appearances.
But if he's appearing, if he is genuinely appearing after being genuinely dead...
But that's what I don't think was the case. We have a whole lot of people who think they saw him. But then this is what happens with...
What is a better explanation of the historical data we have?
That they were grief-related appearances.
Now, you don't mean real appearances. You mean grief...
Ostensible appearances, yes. Seemed to them what the old-time philosophers would call sense data.
Okay, so you're basically, if you're going to say grief visions, you're saying hallucinations.
If you like, yes.
Yes, because the other way, it sounds like you're almost believing the resurrection. I know that's not what you're saying.
I should have said... to use
it would be a short discussion if it were, wouldn't it?
Right here on your campus, Tony Flew just likes the resurrection. No, that's not... could these have been grief-related hallucinations? That's what he means when he says grief visions. We've done this a few times. We've been on some other... We spent a whole discussion on this, a whole 3 hours on this a few years ago, on the grief visions. But I'll tell you real briefly... The issue with most people on any kind of hallucination, whether it's grief-related hallucination or any other hallucination, there's probably no theory that is fraught with more difficulties than this one. But here's a few of them real quickly. People don't see hallucinations in groups. An hallucination is no more objective than a dream. An hallucination, by definition, is when you believe something so strongly you make the mental image. Well, obviously, I don't see your mental image. The mental image you create. By the way, we should understand how radical hallucinations are, too. If you're driving down the road and you look like you're seeing water across the road in the summertime, or you come home at night and it's cold and you take a coat off and put it up on one of the post of your bed and put your hat on top of it, wake up in the middle of the night and think somebody's standing in your room, those aren't hallucinations because you're seeing data and misinterpreting them. So those are different. But hallucination, as you said, is something for which there's no objective referent. Mm-hmm. It's standing and talking to my deceased grandmother, who I just know all of you see right here, mm-hmm. where there's no other data. So it's a pretty radical claim, and it's a private claim. So anytime you have groups of people who believe they saw the risen Jesus, if they believe they saw him in groups... You have to have each individual having an individual hallucination, which is highly problematic. For example, in Paul, you and I have discussed before Paul's list in 1 Corinthians 15, which I don't think there's a critic around who's going to deny the earliness in Paul's listing these appearances. And several of them are individuals, Peter, James, Paul, but he also lists three groups. He said Jesus appeared to 12. He appeared to all the apostles at once. He appeared to 500 brethren at one time. Well, group appearances are very, very difficult for hallucinations because you don't hallucinate in groups. Another issue is the different personalities involved. You got men, women, indoors, outdoors, walking, standing, sitting. You know, you don't manufacture hallucinations every time you when you change scenarios. That militates against hallucination. There's a second issue. Another one is that they weren't in the right frame of mind. I mean, in the Gospels, one of the facts up there. Is that they were disillusioned. They were in a state of despair. A hallucination generally comes from a state of a heightened state, not a down state. Another problem is the empty tomb. If there were hallucinations, there would have been a body in the tomb. And like I said, this is Jerusalem, so you could have strolled down to the tomb on an afternoon and saw that the tomb was empty. But of course, if it's hallucinations, a body's still there. One more thing, we could go on, but hallucinations generally don't change lives. I know a couple guys who've researched Navy SEALs who they put themselves in situations where they frequently see hallucinations. You get hallucinations from bodily deprivation when you're denied food and water for weeks. And these guys, they're supposed to work together in groups. And there's some research done on this. And they are talked out of these things by their friends. And when you ask them later, well, why don't you see the octopus waving to you and smiling, which is one Navy SEAL said. Another one picked up an oar and he was swinging it over the top of the boat. And he said, what are you doing? He said, porpoises are jumping over the ship. One of them jumped off of the ship into the water, and one of the captain said, what are you doing down there in the water? And the guy said, a train's coming right for us. Now, these obviously aren't objective. When later, when they were interviewed, and they'd say, well, how come porpoises weren't jumping over your ship? Or how come there wasn't a train out there? How come there wasn't an octopus smiling and waving? They said two things. Those things don't happen, and my buddies didn't see it. Now, if you apply those same two things to the resurrection appearances, my buddies didn't see it, if they're individual hallucinations. And secondly, these things don't happen. Dead men don't rise, to quote David Hume. So they're convinced against themselves. Anyway, there's a bunch of other problems. James and Paul are two huge issues because they were unbelievers. So why would they manufacture hallucinations? That's just a string.
Can I just ask a question? Is the issue then we're comparing improbabilities to be wildly improbable to have a group hallucination of this sort? But I wonder what the improbability of that compared to the improbability of someone being dead,
right,
raised again, and
right,
then actually being the Son of God in those. It seems to me that the intrinsic improbability is greater on the latter than the former, isn't it?
You know who you're quoting here? That guy right there. His encyclopedia.
I told you he was an eminent philosopher.
Yes, he was. Yes, he is. He wrote the article on miracles for the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and he raised that same issue. And it's a great question. But to me, the problem is this. All right, let's take a look at that one. Okay, what's more unlikely, a group hallucination or a resurrection? And you said you would think on the surface that a resurrection would be stranger than a group hallucination, even though we don't know any group hallucinations in history either. But still, a resurrection would be stranger. The problem is, it's not a one-time exception. If what the New Testament records is true, there are appearances to Peter, to James, who's an unbeliever, to Paul, who's an unbeliever, to 500 at once, to the apostles, to the disciples, to the women. So you have multitudes of groups. Now I would ask you, what's more likely? A number of group hallucinations or a resurrection? What I mean is, it's not just one appearance. You start mounting up the issues again. I agree with you. It is a probabilities issue.
Right. Well, but, you know, I don't know that you have to be committed to, there could be deceptions. Some people say they have an appearance and they don't.
And the vision of the 500, that does seem to me, you know, we really don't have evidence of that would satisfy anyone if it wasn't accompanied by things that they were more inclined to believe, like the ones to Paul and so on. I mean, that claim tossed out as, oh yes, and there were an appearance to 500. That's always seemed to me a very odd and arbitrary and implausible addition.
The reason it's taken seriously is that it's in Paul's list in 1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah.
And that list, as I said, he said he received it from somebody else, and critics think it can be dated to 35 AD in Jerusalem. So this list is taken very seriously because, by the way, they're non-Pauline words. It's a memorized list that's codified. You can tell by the script, the way they lead into it. There are dozens of these things in the New Testament. They are texts that were oral testimony, oral preaching, before the earliest books were written. Paul says he received this. And again, most critics put this in Jerusalem, 35 AD. The reason they take it so seriously is because the appearance of the 500 is in the list that he gives in 1 Corinthians 15. That's why the appearance of the 500 is taken so seriously, because it comes from this earliest strand of evidence.
I'm afraid that this thing tends to discredit anything it's associated with, it seems to me.
But why would it be an issue? I mean, if Jesus preached to larger groups than that, you know,
yeah,
we have the famous, the feeding of the 5,000 incident.
Yeah.
There's another group of 4,000. If there were thousands of people there on occasion, why is it a priori odd that 500 people would be together?
I mean, I'm afraid the feeding of the 5,000 is one of the statements that I find great difficulty in believing.
But what I'm saying is, as far as a group of people coming together, just the fact that you could, 500 is, you know, nothing to have together, say, Passover season. You've got many times that. But you've got a group of 500. But the issue is not how many people.
But a group of 500 having a vision is much more remarkable than a group of 500 or 501 or 499 come together. It seems to me it is utterly disproportionate to all the other claims and would require very much stronger evidence.
What do you think about appearing to 12 people at once or appearing to the apostles? Do you like that better? See, if you appeared to anybody, you still have a resurrection.
Oh, yes, yes. You have a resurrection, but the thing that still remains is the... this is extraordinary enough, but getting to more on the basis of these clearly miraculous occurrences.
Well, can I ask you this question? You don't like the appearances. What would count? For a resurrection, could anything count, or is it in principle that is just so wildly implausible? I don't care what I don't know if you have a videotape or something. What would count? Perhaps video would. I don't know.
Well, yes.
That would help.
I just happen to have one here. They'll be on sale in the back of the room.
Yes.
I like a cut of that.
A special bargain offer.
A special bargain just tonight.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great question. What would count as good evidence?
I'm not sure I can answer that one at all. No.
Let me put an additional little barb in it. Theology and falsification.
Mm. Yes.
An article that you wrote in 1955?
It was published in 1955, I think. Yes.
Well, it was good. It was good. But you said it counts against a view when it's unfalsifiable. In fact, you
absolutely
used it today
yeah,
of the
yes.
Muslim view.
Yeah, yes.
Is your view unfalsifiable?
My unbelief, you mean?
Against the resurrection.
Yes.
If you have this list of facts, and every time we bring something up, it seems to be opposed by a number of rejoinders that say, boy, cut me off of that one. Oh, yeah, okay. And you start answering your questions. At what point do you say, looks like a resurrection? Or at what point would you say your view is or is not falsifiable?
I think the only honest answer is I can't think at the moment. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Tony Flew is responding to Tony Flew here.
Yes, yes. yes, I think the unfalsifiability of unbelief is somehow a different problem from the unfalsifiability of a belief.
But if you can't falsify, if there's no probable rejoinder to resurrection, and you're left with, well, I don't want to believe it anyway. Now, of course, that's your right.
Yeah.
But it's your belief that's unfalsifiable, then, right?
Yes, though one could, I suppose, always imagine things that would be just overwhelming confirmation.
Would a resurrection falsify your belief? Could this be it? Could this be the data that would... I mean, in principle, it would be, wouldn't it?
I suppose I have an almost invincible disinclination to believe the whole resurrection story, yes, because it seems to me so wildly inconsistent with everything else that happens in the universe.
Maybe the universe is different too. I mean, that's another issue, but
yes,
maybe this is one of those singularities, you might say, that might make you question a lot of other stuff, if it were true.
Oh, yeah, I think the answer to that must be certainly yes. Yes. That it is just so extraordinary if actually the whole thing happens, you know, straightforwardly. They are creatures of flesh and blood that the apostles see and so on.
It would be rather
wonderful,
wouldn't it? And
Thomas could put his thumb, or was it his finger, in and all that.
Sure.
The whole total story is so wildly unlike the things that happen in Los Angeles even.
But, you know, we talked earlier today, we had a lecture in here on near-death experiences.
Yes.
I mean, a near-death experience is not a resurrection, to be sure.
No.
But the highly evidenced ones, you see what I'm saying? A highly evidenced near-death experience where somebody reports data with a flat EEG for 3 hours, and they report things that they saw during these 3 hours when the brain wasn't working, I mean, that's not a resurrection. But what I mean is it raises the bar a little bit. It says to you,
yeah,
wow, this world might be a little different than what we think it is.
This is going to be looked at and has been looked at by people studying it as the putative phenomenon of extrasensory perception. And, of course, there are complications in the theory of this, that there's also something retroactive extrasensory perception.
But even if it is, even if it is, you have something rather, I mean, what if we gave a definition of life after death of something like extrasensory perception after death? What I mean is,
yeah,
this extrasensory perception puts it off a little bit, but if you have people reporting things when their brain isn't functioning and they seem to be alive and well,
yeah,
and we have dozens of these cases, the highly evidenced kinds, I'm just saying.
But they're extrasensorily perceiving things that were going on when they were brain dead, isn't that it?
Brain dead.
Yes.
Right. I'm not trying to get us off the subject. I'm just saying.
No, no.
I'm saying there could be.
It's about to intervene.
I was just going to say there could be things in this world that show the world is not quite.
Oh,
very
much.
That's all I was saying.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question about that? Because that sort of thing would say to me that if the world, by which you mean the world, the laws of nature, may be different from what we understand them to be, perhaps.
Or there may be adjustments to them.
Right. Okay. But do you really want to say that the Christian confidence in the resurrection of Christ is a part of the natural order of things that we just haven't discovered yet? Or do you want to say it's a supernatural intervention?
Sure. You can get that a couple ways. Of course, Jesus claimed, all right, he says these special things about himself. He says he'll be raised from the dead to show who he was. He says, I'm the only one in the universe who knows the God of the universe, and the resurrection will show that this is me. He's raised from the dead. Okay, now when you put that together, I think that's where you get the supernatural conclusion. Because his claim is that the God of the universe is acting upon him. And whatever else you do with it, I mean, that is a supernatural claim. Now, on the other point of the natural claim, if somebody said to me, well, what if we find an explanation in the future? What if 100 years from now we find something that makes sense? And I would just say the same thing we do of all scientific theses. I would say, well, then let's face it in 100 years, or let people face it in 100 years. But as far as we're concerned, we need to decide on the data we have. We can only do what we have with right now, and I think that's something, you know, we would agree to. But you can only make a decision now based on what you have now, not invest in a. I mean, that's just two ways to look at it. But the other way was Jesus made these special claims, and it seems that he claimed that the resurrection showed that the God of the universe was acting upon him. So I would say supernatural to answer your question.
Well, it just occurs to me that if it were more like the extrasensory thing, you know, that surely someone could have the ability and be mistaken even about what the nature of that ability was. So it just doesn't seem to me if it were just a, you know, someone. I once heard a lecture where someone claimed that Jesus' death was not real on the cross, but was a technique that he learned studying yoga, right? And I took yoga for a year, and I didn't get that surviving the crucifixion lesson. But
let me give you an illustration.
I think I missed that day.
Yes. But
I'm wondering what would warrant the inference, just because he makes a claim, and you're making the case that there's strong historical evidence that the appearances.
He makes
are understood
claims,
real.
And he,
but
right.
And he makes an additional claim that involves a claim that there's a God and I'm the Son of God and this uniqueness. But I'm just having a hard time making that compatible with the view that maybe the world is different than what we know, because the world being different would make it a part of natural phenomena that we just don't know yet. And it seems to me that the Christian view would be something that. You know, what would it be to have a whole bunch of natural evidence that somehow adds up to supernatural?
Except the resurrection itself would be pretty tough to explain in natural order. I mean, David Hume, in section 1, says it would be a resurrection if a man would be raised from the dead. So it would seem, of course he didn't admit that, but it would. There are some things on the surface. We're not adding a bunch of non-supernaturals to get a supernatural. The resurrection itself would seem to be a very supernatural claim, at least according to a lot of people. As far as I know, you're teasing about the yoga thing, but the thing with people who are practicing yoga or practicing anything, if they are held underwater for 10 minutes, they're dead whether they're practicing yoga or not.
Yeah.
And a person who's on the cross, if what I said earlier is true, and you're slumped in the lower position, you're dying whether you're, you know, the guy.
I have no doubts about.
Oh, I know you don't. But I mean, I say to people sometimes. If I hang on the cross and I say, I hope I'll, by the way, I know a guy who got up on this thing, a guy with a medical doctor, who got up on one of these deals and was crucified himself. He said within 2 minutes there was excruciating pain in his chest. But if a person's going to be in the low position on the cross for, let's say, 10 minutes, no discipline is going to keep them from breathing. So you've got that's the built-in checks and balances. And I know you're not questioning that. I'm just, when you mentioned the yoga thing, I just throw that out there. You know that there are built-in checks and balances on the cross that guarantee this. So
an awkward pause hovers over our panel.
I think it's your business to say something else.
Oh, do you? Well, Professor Flew, according to your position, then the best explanation for the data, if you're willing to accept it, is some kind of illusion. So, what is your response to the unlikelihood of, you know, a collective?
Well,
I know you're not a collectivist, but this would be a different kind of collectivist.
No, I'm afraid back to the situation of the almost invincible unbelief. This is so unlike anything in the rest of my experience of the world that I just don't know how to cope with this at all.
And is invincible unbelief unfalsifiable?
Well,
his view would be if it's unfalsifiable, it's meaningless.
I don't think this would be so. No, I suppose I can imagine a series of developments which would make it clear to me that the universe wasn't at all as I had previously thought it to be. But, of course, I don't think anyone believes that this is going to happen. They believe that this is a unique, central thing. The most important fact in human history. Isn't that a position that any Christian believer would have to say about these facts or alleged facts?
Could I ask you
they
this?
They just don't have any analogy in any experience of anything else. This was essentially a once-for-all divine intervention in the affairs of the universe. Isn't that roughly what the claim is?
It'd be a pretty major one.
Yeah.
So it's your view that those who believe now in the resurrection, at least their beliefs are not warranted. They're not justified.
Oh, no, I don't think I'd want to say that. Because, I think to say this with absolute confidence, they're not justified. Because one of the points I'm particularly wanting to make on this occasion is that reasonable people may make disastrous mistakes on what the basis of what they themselves had good reason to believe.
So this is a disastrous mistake, but a rational.
Well, I don't want to say it's irrational for other people to believe in this. It seems to me it may be perfectly rational for them to believe in this, but I can't cope with this idea at all. It seems to me so unlike anything else that happens in the universe. And the way I would normally approach this is by taking a favorite example of mine, the commander of a unit of tanks, who, because the available intelligence that he had, and he had every reason to expect that the ICOR in his army had got it right, it usually did, but in fact leads his unit into a trap in which massacres the lot of them. You cannot say that he was an irrational man being in that position. And I think this idea can be extended to many other things, to some of the most recent arguments for the existence of God. I think the view about physical
design.
Constant, yes. The people who already believe in God, I think they are quite rational in thinking that this is a confirmation, and ditto with the Big Bang theory. But I don't think, and this I think will become clearly with the fine-tuning argument, thanks for the reminder, with the case of that. Because if the main purpose of the God in creating the whole universe was to have human beings, as would appear from the book of Genesis, in which the God is not apparently a sustaining but only an initiating cause, and therefore his creatures are reasonably free human beings. If his purpose of that, he would surely have created the universe as all the scientists of the Middle Ages believed he had, as the center of the universe, you know, as the view that was overthrown by the scientific work of Copernicus. But the idea that the creator of the universe would plan the universe so the eventual emergence of Earth and human beings was the product of an extraordinarily unlikely coincidence of the physical constants, all of which he presumably formed as the creator of the universe. It seems to me it's positively preposterous to think of this as a positive reason for unbelievers to believe that God created the universe. But I think it's reasonable enough for the people who believe that already to say, gosh, this is confirmation. You show that he planned it all in this extremely subtle way, and he made all the physical constants combined in this way so that it would happen like that.
It would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
It would have been wonderful.
That's the point.
I think this is an important thing to see, that in these matters, people can fundamentally disagree, though they are equally rational people. They are doing what it is entirely reasonable for them to think on the basis of what they already believe.
Let me ask you a question about your tank illustration. A person who makes a rational but very wrong decision, The problem with that, it seems to me, if that was a parable of Christianity, for example, the problem with it is the knife cuts both ways, right? I mean, atheism could be the tank commander, too.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Certainly. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so leave the whole thing.
I'm not saying this is something
it's all fair.
That is reasonable
it's all fair
for
and love and war.
But not for other people. No, I think this applies to all of us.
So we're right back to we have to decide on the data in front of us.
Yes. And in the light of our own, as we think, most reasonable beliefs before we came to this problem.
So if one already believes in a transcendent God, then the issue of the resurrection...
I think this would be a case I've only thought about is in the case of, the latest arguments for the existence of God, which were introduced before I first started thinking about this subject. I was an adolescent before the Big Bang Theory was formulated. How old can you get?
I'm looking at a cheat sheet. And the cheat sheet says that it's almost time, though not quite, but it's about time for closing statements from the speakers, after which we can have a period of questions and, with any luck, answers. So, since we started with, would you like to make a closing statement?
No,
you're done.
Yes.
That was it.
Yes. Okay. That was the thing I particularly wanted to say.
Very
yes.
good. So,
that was the apex of
That's
your
right.
case.
Where do you go from there, right? So perhaps
Home,
you would like
I
to make
that. The
sure. So when I leave tonight, when I think about this, I will remember the tank commander. That's well, let me tell you a little bit about my methodology, which I haven't said yet. I'll say this as sort of tying up everything I've done. The method I use in speaking about the resurrection is this. I don't think a Christian or a non-Christian has to assume that the Bible's inspired or not inspired, trustworthy or not trustworthy. I would rather work from a lowest common denominator position and work up. We started tonight with these facts, and I think that's a way to, and we pretty much agreed on these. We did this one other time, and we had total agreement. We pretty much share those, and I'll tell you what, they're pretty much shared by the whole critical community, Christian and non-Christian alike. Now, if that's a basis, you don't have to say, well, yeah, but it's in the Bible. I don't accept the Bible. That misses the point. The point is, are these historical facts, and are they known on their own grounds, no matter what the source? Do we have good sources for them? I will just throw this out there. We have a dozen and a half sources outside the New Testament for Jesus. Contrary to popular belief, he's one of the most mentioned people in ancient history. In fact, the earliest comment about Jesus could well be from a Greek historian, predating the New Testament. And what he records, by the way, is a miracle. But it's not just New Testament data. But I'm not proposing tonight using the New Testament as someone saying, well, that's your book, or that's inspired, or you think it's reliable. I'm saying if we don't start with any of those, and all we know about the New Testament is that it's a book of ancient literature. And it was Dr. Flew who said today that in his lecture this afternoon that the New Testament comes with very good credentials. But I don't have to even make that assumption. If I just have some data, like what's up here in the board, I think we have to make assumptions, and what comes from those assumptions will have to be linked to the data. Now, I was pleased to hear him say that Christians are rational in believing from their structure, believing in the resurrection. But I think you can get there this way. The single fact that's most important in that list is that the disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. They thought they saw the risen Jesus. Without that, you don't even have a church. So people say, well, of course they thought that. They thought they saw the risen Jesus. Now here's, you have to take that and all these accompanying reasons. They're transformed lives, they're willing to die for it. What do you do with James? What do you do with Paul? They were unbelievers. They too believed Jesus appeared to them. But you have this belief that they thought Jesus appeared to them. And you ask, can I explain this with other hypotheses given of what I know of science or history or philosophy or anything. And if the data looks like Jesus appeared, then I think we have a problem if we're just going to reject it. Or if we say, well, you know, my belief structure doesn't work there. You still have to deal with the data. Now, I will say, too, I have not been a believer in these things all my life. I spent 10 years searching, and I actually rejected the resurrection, and I used to argue with Christians and tell them they were full of it and everything else, and ended up doing my doctoral dissertation on this subject and being convinced it happened. But then also, in 1995, I had a chance to test this, and my wife passed away with stomach cancer. And from, actually, Tony knew her because he came once to our home and stayed with us at the school for a couple weeks, and she passed away just a little bit after that. And then, of course, you have all these issues about evil and pain and evil, like you folks who were here last night heard. And so all I can say is that in 1995, when this happened, in 1995, I had a grad student who called me on the phone, and he asked me, he said, where would you be today if it weren't for the resurrection of Jesus? And I admitted, I mean, I realized that if Jesus was raised from the dead, it makes all the difference in the world. To have somebody who for whom the evidence says it looks like they were raised, and then the New Testament saying over and over again, Christians could be raised like him, that's a pretty significant event. And then when I'm sitting there looking death in the face and losing my wife, I'll just end with the last verses of 1 Corinthians 15, the same passage we've been talking about. Paul basically trash talks death. At the end of 1 Corinthians 15, he says, death, where is your sting? Grave, where is your victory? He's basically saying, you've got nothing. You've got nothing. Because he goes on to say, the answer is the resurrection of Jesus. And that's how he ends. And of course, for him, coming from his background, basically a scholar, Tony called him a very worthy philosopher today. And we have him converting too by what he thinks is the resurrection of Jesus today. So I'll just end with that thought. I think, for me at least, within my noetic structure, if this is something that happened in 30 AD, then it's something that has continuing meaning. And for my family and I, that's all we had in 1995. But I think if you have the resurrection, you have plenty.